Well, welcome to the VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, I'm joined by John through some technical difficulty. John Flowers, how are you?
I'm doing well.
So we're doing this old school. So we really are going to be indebted to our producers today. But it's just you and I today, John, talking about one of my favorite films, The Dark Knight. And we're going to get into a discussion of that. Visual effects primarily by the London crowd being double negative and frame still, but also some help from the French with Boof. So let me just start out by saying that I think you guys did a good job last week, and I'm sorry to have missed Wanted, though it sounded like I may not have been able to add anything. You guys had it pretty well covered.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So look, let's start with Dark Knight, because this is one I've been really looking forward to, and I normally like to start off by just asking whether you actually at an audience participation level enjoyed the film.
Oh yeah, I thought the film was unbelievable. It was massive and epic. It was so expansive. I felt like I was watching Kundun or something, you know, of that nature. There was another film with Christian Bale called Empire of the Sun, and it had that same scope.
Actually, I think Spielberg's work on that film was excellent, but for me, there was a terrific aspect to this film that I haven't seen in comic book films, and I've certainly don't seen many films, which is the story was actually original and it wasn't predictable where it was going, and it didn't feel like a formula where I could just almost predict. I mean, at one end of the spectrum, I've actually watched Starsky and Hutch in French, not speaking a word of French, and being able to predict who was going to go through what door and what was going on just on the camera framing and the predictability of a show at that level. So at the other end of the spectrum, I'm normally sitting in a cinema going, yep, well, that's pretty obvious what's going to happen. And I've complained about this on the VFX show before, especially at the ending of Hulk, which I just found completely formulistic. But for me, let's discuss the story now. It didn't, you know, it wasn't an obvious formulistic layout for me. Would you agree?
I would agree. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Most comic book movies, for lack of a better phrase, have this kind of formula, which is, you know, this sort of manufactured nemesis gets created that is the counterpart to the, you know, in the Hulk's case, this, you know, massive creature. So you have to sort of manufacture this thing that the Hulk can fight. In The Dark Knight, I didn't know. I mean, I'm very familiar with the story, you know, Arkham Asylum and a lot of the history of The Dark Knight and how it should have played out. But even then, it was twists and turns, and yeah, I thought it was unbelievable. The Joker alone was such a crazy, just chaotic character. You had no idea what he was going to do next or what even motivated him.
But what I thought was really nice about it is that, well, at many levels, let's just stay with the plot for one quick second. I totally agree with you. I couldn't agree more that it was great to see a plot line that didn't require the biggest scenes we've seen of the whole movie at the very, very end, and that it was just a big build-up to a big action effects sequence where really the story was forgotten. It was just going to be a fight out, especially it's normally a fight out on the streets of New York with, you know, massive amounts of damage, and then it sort of finishes and the hero sulks off into the sunset. So that was good. I thought that there were some, you know, bold decisions in killing off various key characters at points where you weren't really expecting them from an audience point of view, certainly from that traditional formula point of view, the heroine normally gets saved. But when it comes down to the Joker, the thing that I really liked is that it's very easy to paint a villain as just a lunatic where he's just silly. In other words, he's just randomly doing random things, and this is the annoying thing about them. They're one-dimensional, and they just laugh and carry on and just do bad things, and you get no sense of anything else. And I thought with the Joker, there was a real sense of the character still giving us none of his backstory and yet not looking one-dimensional, and that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, they even reference, they're a little bit self-referential in the film, because there's a point where, you know, Commissioner Gordon is going through all of the Joker's things, and it's like just a lot of knives. You know, we have no fingerprints on this guy. We have no background on him at all. And I thought that was a nice way of saying, you know, here's just this Joker, and he just is. You know, it was a very, very interesting way to portray him. And while I really enjoyed the Jack Nicholson version of the Joker, ultimately this version was so much more maniacal and devious and more real. It was such a rich three-dimensional character.
a rich character, and yet we had no backstory. We have no, you know, quiet moments where he's giving exposition to a henchman. And yet there were little tiny bits of clever writing, like when he explains how he got his scars, and each time it's a sincere discussion about how it happened, but completely different every time. And it was just that, and I just was haunted by the Michael Caine line where he's sort of like, some people just want to see it burn. I thought it was just such a good written approach to a evil nemesis character that was just, you know, you were left with the, if you have a Batman that society throws up, a society is also going to throw up its converse, and for almost as little explanation.
Yeah, one of my favorite films, which does a similar thing, it's both simultaneously one of my favorites and one of the most disappointing films I've ever seen, is a film called Ronin, where you're just kind of airdropped into this guy's life. You don't know anything about him, and you kind of discover him in the same way the characters around him discover him. And I thought that The Dark Knight was an example of doing that, you know, that story where you just put the audience into this character without any knowledge of who he is, just kind of walk into his life and get to know him. And I thought it was amazing. The two, you know, most memorable and haunting scenes, of course, are where he makes the pencil disappear and where he burns the money.
Yeah, yeah. I did actually think that, I mean, the pencil disappearing is just some of the best. I mean, making an audience jump for so little visual violence on screen. I'll give you another reference back. There's a film from New Zealand, Once We Were Warriors, and I found it to be one of those violent films I'd seen, and yet there was hardly any actual violence in it. It was just the sort of psychological implied violence and good filmmaking. And in the same sense, that scene with the pencil is incredibly violent, and yet you see so little. In an age of, you know, high body count and blood and guts, you just don't see that much. And yet the whole audience, when I was watching it, just jumped.
Yeah, the audience where I saw it, they gasped and shifted uncomfortably in their chairs, and it took them a moment to recover.
Now, absolutely. Of course, I guess I'm being building to the fact also that I think the performance by Heath Ledger is exceptionally good. You must agree.
I don't know, yeah. Oh, of course. There's what else can you say? I mean, I'm not even sure what kind of category to put it into. He was so transformed. My fiance, who went to see the movie with me, walked out of the movie and looked over at me and said, "I got to tell you, there not once in that film did I see Heath Ledger behind the Joker's face."
Well, you know, I think his performance in Brokeback Mountain was just equally magnificent, and it's such a good thing that we have that other performance to compare to, because it would be easy to think that, you know, what you saw in the Joker character was just, you know, an individual who was in of themselves anarchic and quite wild, and they got a wild boy to play the role, and that's what came through. And of course, that isn't the case at all. Heath Ledger was a very quiet and very serious actor, and that is just acting at its finest, I think.
Absolutely. And I have to admit a guilty pleasure, which is, you know, one of my all-time favorite. I'm kind of a big fan of what you might call teen drama, and one of my all-time favorite films in that genre is 10 Things I Hate About You, which Heath Ledger is also in.
Yeah. Okay. That's definitely guilty pleasure department.
That's on the Starsky and Hutch side of the equation, I think.
Hey, I was in France skiing, and there was only French television on. So Heath Ledger's performance is terrific, and he's not the only one, though. I do think that the supporting cast, and I do love Morgan Freeman. There's just nothing he's been in I don't like, and I really think that Michael Caine is magnificent. So all of those supporting casts were also really good, and, you know, it's a bit of an ensemble cast, though it seems to be fairly dominated in terms of the acting through the work of Heath Ledger. But I guess one thing that's been brought up is that the nature of this film has very little in terms of the first film's Christian Bale's Bruce Batman in a kind of torment. Was that something that you thought was correct because we'd done that story and we'd moved on? Or did you feel that attention had just been given to Heath Ledger?
Well, I It's a difficult question to answer because I didn't see a lot of the Torment. I do think the Torment was explored quite well in the first one, and we really got a sense of who Batman and Bruce Wayne are in the first film. I have to say, not to derail the conversation, I was a little disappointed in the sort of humanity of Batman, or the, I guess, how am I trying to put this? Batman was a little too human for me. He just seemed a little too easily knocked down and a little too, I don't know, he just didn't seem like as much of a superhero, as much of an unstoppable force as he did in the first film. And I saw a slow progression where he kind of got that back toward the end of the film. So maybe that was something that the director did intentionally, is make him a little bit weaker in the beginning and kind of bring him back to where he was stronger toward the end.
Well, I personally think that it was a very valid vehicle to do that, because this whole idea that they're killing innocent people until he unmasked, you know, that really did produce this problem for our hero, which is one that's been, I mean, it's actually happened in real life, and there are cases in various Asian and European dictatorships where people have, you know, in real life had to either come forward and admit to stuff or have innocents killed. And it's probably the hardest thing to place a hero in front of, because to come forward and give yourself up or reveal yourself in this particular case is the end of being able to do good. And then by the same token, you can't sit by and watch innocents killed. So I actually didn't have a problem with that at all. And I guess for me, I really was of the school that we'd explored that so well in the first film. And my big, as you yourself, or rather your team, quoted me as saying in one of your podcasts, I thought this was very much like The Godfather Part 2 for our generation. And the reason that I said that was that the story was not a sequel where the sequel was picking up on the first one, trying to find where all the good hit points were in that and then repeat them. See, the first film for me had a good angst, a good backstory, and a good Batman struggle thing. And we'd done that. So I wanted them to do a different film. Now, normally sequels would say, well, that's what made the first film a successful, so let's do that again. And so in a whole lot of the characters, even for me, another standout performance was Gary Oldman. And in his performance, he was playing his character, having moved on in time and moved on in confidence and in everything. And I just felt that was so great that we had a sequel that didn't feel that the first one was successful, so we're going to have to try and find that formula and repeat it. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's probably worth saying that the performance is all around. Aaron Eckhart probably doesn't get the kind of credit that he deserves, but his performance as Harvey Dent was just spectacular. I bought that character completely.
And yeah, yeah.
You know, like you said, you could watch this one. You could almost watch this one standalone without having watched the first one and still feel like Godfather 2, which is the, you know, film you compare it to. You can still feel like it's a freestanding, very well-constructed film that doesn't require the information in the previous film to make it work. I mean, it's its own movie, absolutely.
I think the other thing that I really liked about it is I felt that the end had a certain operatic quality to it. And by that, I mean that there was almost a Greek tragedy nature to the very, very ending of the film. I don't know if we should even give it away, but for those that haven't seen it, but I guess by this point, if you haven't seen the film, you shouldn't be listening to this podcast. So let me just give you this sort of spoiler alert that we're about to go into major spoilers. So at the very end of the film, the idea that that our main character has to not only sort of take the burden of having lost the woman he loves, but also that he is the bad guy, was terribly Greek tragedy to me. And that's the sort of operatic feel that I felt that we got from The Godfather, and that sense of, you know, a hero unreluctantly having to take a role that they necessarily wouldn't take if they weren't in the situation they were in. And I loved that. Does that make sense to you? Am I being too ethereal?
Well, you're being a little bit ephemeral, but that's okay. I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, how would you characterize Godfather 2 as a film? I mean, is it a drama? Is it a suspense? Is it a thriller? Is it a gangster movie? Well, in a way, it's all of these things. Just like I think The Dark Knight is, in a way, you know, very much a genre-crossing kind of film. The scene with the Joker walking down the street where he's just, you know, he grabs a gun and just kind of becomes berserk. You know, I felt like I was... I feel like I should be hearing like Carmina, you know, Burana, just operatic sort of music in the background at that point.
Now let's move now from those performances to the elements that help make something like that work. And we're obviously going to mainly discuss the VFX, but in that scene right there, that is superb cinematography as well. That is really well framed, really well. I mean, it would have been easier to punch in a lot closer, and yet that just felt like it was lit. You know, it was obviously theatrically lit in a sense, in that, you know, there was obviously perfect lighting for what was going on, but it was also very dramatic, you know, really hitting the beat. I think it was Hollywood sort of cinematography at its finest.
Is that one of the scenes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's one of the scenes that was actually shot in IMAX? And then,
have you seen the film IMAX?
I have. I've seen it both, the standard version and the IMAX version.
So let's discuss that as well. Discussing cinematography. That was the scene, because that right up to the truck flip was in IMAX.
Yes.
And
I knew the truck flip was.
Yeah. That scene alone is a reason to go see it in IMAX. So let's discuss IMAX, because we're discussing cinematography. I mean, in the audience that I saw it, and I saw it actually before it opened to the public, but it was a full IMAX cinema. When the first shot came of the beginning of the bank heist at looking at the building, and I actually discussed this with Paul Franklin in our podcast on FX Guide, the audience in my cinema that I was sitting in just either gasped or clapped. It was just such a magnificent experience to see that at IMAX. And it wasn't just the film starting. It was that you'd gone from the opening credits, which were, you know, cropped effectively, letterbox black top and bottom, to get it to a normal cinema aspect ratio, and it just expanded out to this massive image, such beautiful quality, that the audience was like literally just applauded in appreciation. You must have loved it as well.
Oh yeah, and I'm curious, I've been trying to wrap my brain around, because I do some editing and you know, work of that nature, and I've shot some, you know, some film. I am impressed, and completely impressed, by the editor's ability to convert between the 2:4:1, you know, 2:4:1, and the IMAX, where it didn't feel visually jarring. It felt so fluid and so dynamic, it never really yanked me out of the film. Now, in the opening scene, or the opening credits, when it, you know, goes from the opening credits to the IMAX footage, that is a little visually jarring, but I think they wanted it to be. I think they wanted to set kind of some foreshadowing of, here's what you're going to, you know, see throughout the rest of the film, so we're going to make this kind of obvious the first time, but after that it's going to be fluid.
So I think, from my personal, my next comment is not based on some kind of insider knowledge, it's just my personal observation of the editing. What he was doing, or what they were doing for those edit points that was working very well, is he tended to have a fairly dark shot before you went like either side of that edit point. So on the opener, you went from a dark shot of the credit roll to a very bright shot, full exterior outside, and so you really noticed it pop. Whereas on some of the other transitions, they would go to the IMAX on a IMAX frame that was kind of dark, and so you were less jarred between the black at the top of frame jumping to a new bright section. Does that make sense? So if you had a dark either side of that edit point where you went from one format to the other, you didn't kind of notice it suddenly opening up as much. So it was clever editing, but also I think they were really picking the points at which they cut between one and the other. When they cut to a full exterior from an interior that was one format to an exterior that was IMAX and well lit, that's when it really popped. That's when you really went, aha. And I only saw one of those, which was the Hong Kong first IMAX shot, where they went from a dark shot to a bright shot and you really noticed instantly, whereas some of the other ones, they'd have gone to IMAX and then I'd sort of take a beat to realize I was watching IMAX and suddenly start appreciating, wow, look at all this extra stuff on the screen.
Absolutely. Yeah, I again, you know, they had a lot of great material to work with, and I was also surprised, while we're talking about the color in the shots and the brightness and how dark it is, I was totally blown away by how dark and brooding this film is just in general. I mean, it's incredibly well lit, but it's a dark film. Most of the scenes, there's just absolute inky blackness around the edges.
And yeah, did you notice how bright they actually played with that the other way as well? They actually had periods where they were lighting up for the Joker, and darkening down for Batman in terms of lighting levels. to play against the sort of common thread of the mood getting darker as you, and you know, closing down. And so they discuss this in American Cinematographer, the actual lighting plans and how they were related to the subtext of the film. And it's a fascinating read. I must admit, it is astonishing how good the lighting is, and yet how it's so easy to completely skip over it. I mean, we discuss this with visual effects, right? Visual effects work really well. You don't notice them. Never is that more true than in the lighting that the cinematographer has done. In this film, there was just, as you say, magnificent lighting and just really nice little subtle touches. Like when they're about to go off, Batman and Alfred are walking towards the exit of their underground lair. Batman's about to declare who he is, and the lighting of that whole room, which was this just massive kind of set of white overlit panels, just slowly switch themselves off as they walk, leaving a silhouette of the characters as they sort of go up in the elevator. It just, you didn't need it, but it must have taken forever to get that right and to hold the lighting levels and do it. And it just was, you know, somebody loved this film. That and the fact that the IMAX format, because it works, you know, we're used to discussing the fact that when you shoot HD, it's a smaller chip, hence it's got bigger depth of field, and then you go to a 35 sensor and it's got better, shallower depth of field to make it look more filmic. But obviously on the IMAX format, it's so big that you've got these wide shots with a depth of field that's similar to what you'd expect from a 300mm lens. I mean, there were shots of Michael Caine where his nose was in focus and his ears were out of focus.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. Some of that, I believe some of this was shot on the with a Hasselblad lens, is that correct?
Yep, they were using Hasselblads in the IMAX cameras, or some of them, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and actually, so some of that, actually, of course, the lens itself is so, the depth of field in that lens is so amazing. You know, some of that's just a result of the lens. I mean, obviously you have to have someone talented operating it. I was looking and I noticed that I believe it's Wally Pfister. I'm not quite, it's P-F-I-S-T-E-R. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name, so I apologize for that. He was also the director of photography in Laurel Canyon and The Italian Job. And of course The Prestige and Batman Begins. But Laurel Canyon, if you haven't seen it, is just unbelievable. The photography in that anyway.
Yeah, no, there's some great night stuff in that as well. And I thought The Italian Job was good. The Prestige, I guess, was probably the most, obviously similar kind of, they had some very interesting lighting plays and again, another great film. So let's discuss the VFX per se. And it was obviously made more difficult by the fact that some of it was done at such incredibly high resolution. So lead facility on this... on this film was Dienegg. So Dienegg did primarily, they did a lot of things, but they did things such as the chase sequence and the motorbike. And then Framestore also helped out with doing the face of Two-Face, or the side of the face of Two-Face, which was extremely difficult work, I'm sure, and also stuff in Hong Kong with the elaborate escape. And then Boof, I believe, did the vision stuff that was the invention of Morgan Freeman, the slightly stretching an idea that cell phones could be used to produce three-dimensional imaging.
Right, the sonar vision scenes.
Yeah. So let's work our way in reverse and start with the sonar vision and work our way towards the bat chase. So the sonar vision was, for me, the one thing that took me out of the film, and it wasn't a huge thing. It's just that clearly having some idea about maths and physics, I didn't buy for a second that you could turn every cell phone into a 3D imaging device, nor would you have the bandwidth to send back the information to do it, nor even if you did it, you'd have any way of actually scanning the data to find what you wanted in it. But visually, how did it work for you?
Well, visually, it was stunning. I mean, you know, I, like you, I have a familiarity with technology and how cell phone triangulation works and all of these other things, so I had to really bite my tongue and say, okay, ignore the reality of this and just, you know, look at it for what it is. You have this, you know, guy who has so much money, he can do whatever he wants, you know, so let's just pretend this can happen. And so once I did that, which frankly took a few seconds for me to just let go of it, I thought visually it was amazing. I was really, really impressed with just the sheer number of monitors that they had in the background of Morgan Freeman and Christian Bale's characters, just displaying information. I mean, that is really hard to do, as you know, to have that look seamless and like it's part of the, you know, part of the work that's, you know, being filmed. I don't know how you felt about it.
I thought it was good. I had the same problem. Like at some level, when it was Batman's character himself who wired it up for the whole city, I was like, well, great. Not only is this guy a kung fu expert and he's able to do things, but the guy has a Nobel Prize up his sleeve in sonic detection and electronics. But I think the scene that it played strongest in, of course, was the hostage, non-hostage Joker end kind of sequence. And it played very well, I think, there. It was probably, for me, as I say, just the weakest thing in the sense that it was a device. And I don't have any problem with that. It's just that in comparison to some of the other stuff where everything was not a device, having kind of weird bat vision was just a gadgety thing. And I guess to a certain extent, if we hadn't had that, I'd probably be sitting here right now complaining that there was a lack of gadgets and, you know, he became just a... Because it's always been a part of the mythos that there is a great technological kind of edge and the guy is a normal person with, you know, where do you get those marvelous toys kind of aspect. So, and I think that from a visual effects point of view, they did a great job doing it, and also making it readable enough that an audience could follow the geography of what was going on with an incredibly complex attack sequence. Because when the SWAT team attacks, you do need some idea of the geography. Otherwise, a lot of the tricks that Batman comes up with to solve problems, such as the SWAT guys all being tied together and tossed out the window, they just fail and the audience just gets confused and it's just, well, wait till all this noise and clutter is over and then someone will tell me in a piece of exposition what the hell just happened. And that is a problem that I've seen a lot. People are so keen to get fight sequences and choreographed sequences with stuntmen so fast, so handheld, that you've just completely lost any geography and you don't know where you are. So add into that mix a visual effects that's so visually different than just the normal line of sight, and I think that it could have been a complete mismatch and, you know, visual annoyance. And it didn't feel that way. I certainly felt the SWAT team sequence worked. Were you comfortable with that?
Yeah, I have to agree with you in the sense that you cannot overemphasize enough how difficult it is to set up the audience with a, you know, absolutely new way of looking at information, get them comfortable with that new way of looking at information, and then share all of that new information with them in a way where you cut back and forth between, you know, this sonar vision and, you know, the real action that's happening, and it makes sense, you know. And that was stunning. I had no problems following it. I don't know anyone in the audience who had any real problems following it. All my friends thought it was visually amazing. You know, and like you said, it goes back to the mythos. In the comic book, there is a sonar vision, and it's obviously created differently, but it has that same sort of appeal, and it's one of the reasons how Batman is able to move around in the darkness, you know, and still be effective.
Yeah, and,
which is really interesting.
And the idea of Sonic and ties in with bats and how they naturally see in the wild, and I'm good with all of that. I mean, let's face it, it is Batman. We can't be like holding it up to, you know, this isn't a Meryl Streep urban drama. This is a superhero film. You want him to do something.
Right. And it worked. You know, it's interesting because I think about the sonar vision in the same way that I think about the heads-up display in Iron Man. And,
yeah,
you know, because they're both really complicated and trying to give you just a tremendous amount of information all at once. And I thought for what they were trying to accomplish, both of those techniques worked incredibly well.
If I was to pick one, I'd pick the Iron Man. The heads-up display in Iron Man I thought was just magnificent. I mean, it was raising that kind of computer monitor readout stuff to a new level, and I think the guys that did that did a superb job. But, yeah, I agree. I think it was good.
Yeah.
Let's move back now to working backwards to Two-Face and the side of his face in particular. And boy, am I glad I didn't have to track that sucker. Technically and aesthetically, how did that work for you?
You know what's really funny about it? When I first... So, I'm familiar with the with a story, so I'm familiar with Two-Face, and I guess we are too from previous films, although frankly I've kind of not remembered a lot of the previous Batman films before Batman Begins on purpose. So I guess
really,
we're familiar with the Two-Face and
those
the whole thing.
Those bat suit nipples didn't bother you?
Yeah, I've blocked it from my mind. So you see his face in the shadows, and you just keep thinking, this guy is going to turn his head at some point, and I'm going to be exposed to something. You know, is it going to be prosthetic? Is it going to be computer-generated? What am I going to be looking at? And then when he turns his head, and you actually see the burn and the way that it looks, I thought it was magnificent. I thought it was unbelievable. There were a couple of times where it felt a little weird because it just... I don't know if it was the special effects or just my head saying, there is no way this is real, right? But I thought it was magnificent.
I think that's the only thing. Like, it was one of those designs, like the actual design of the amount of burn on the face, that almost led you to thinking, you know, I mean, I was like, okay, so how does that eye have tear ducts? And if it doesn't have tear ducts, how does it work as an eye? I guess the only thing, if I was being super picky, and this is horrible to be, you know, sort of a full-time quarterback, but I think that's the American expression. I got that one wrong, but whatever. I always try and throw an American expression and get it completely wrong. I'm like that. But the only thing I would have done is I probably would have almost made the burn eye actually look like it only had very, very partial sight, like, you know, have almost frosted over the... Because... To me, they were trying to pull the second eye, the burn eye, off as looking as valid as the first eye, and it just is too exposed and must have been through too much trauma to be looking that good. And so then not sort of having the eye looking good in the sense of, you know, seeming like it's a fully functioning eye, then led me to start thinking about how the hell the eye would work and how it would have managed to burn off everything else around the eye and not actually, you know, stop the eye from working. And I'm talking super minor stuff here, like when I saw the face, that all started running through my head. Now, having said that, I think in the real world, if someone actually had a horrific injury and one was confronted with that, and I'm leaving aside, of course, the compassion for anyone that actually has had a serious burn injury, which is, you know, one of the most painful things of all. But, you know, it is hard to get past one's own almost mental curiosity or mental kind of factoring of what happens. I mean, I'm not trying to say anything grotesque here, but when obviously somebody has horrific injuries like we've seen out of people from landmines and stuff, then I think the mind does go into a kind of a play on what must have happened or how that is or just whatever, because you can't process a face that way without kind of getting to a next level of thinking. So it was almost an impossible task to not have me go and start thinking about that for a moment in the film. And it was a dramatic reveal, and you were just going to start looking at it and realizing that that was a muscle that controlled the jaw, etc., etc. And I think anything less than that, if it had been like just a big sort of, you know, I mean, I was felt almost the same way when I saw Jerry Hall's face in, which I thought was another really good reveal in that first Tim Burton production.
Yeah, I think you probably hit it on the head. I haven't been able to quite wrap my mind around why it didn't work for me, but I think the hyper-realism of the remaining, of the eye remaining kind of in a sea of scar tissue and burn and all of that, I think that's probably what didn't work. Or at least made me kind of go, wow, what? There's something just not aesthetically working about this. And I understand why they did it, because it's frankly creepy as hell, right?
But I mean, okay, I'm going to be slightly stupid now, but it was like he had really good visine, like, or you know, the eye drops. Like, even after all that burn, he didn't have red eyes. No, that was looking good. You know, it's like, wow, you know, if I don't get enough sleep, I have, like, eyes that look worse than that. Yet alone having the side of my face burn off. So. But now if we talk about it, not in terms of the design, but in terms of the implementation, I thought the tracking was flawless. I mean, I'm looking at that sucker on IMAX. I'm a visual effects guy who knows at some point I'm going to be discussing it and reviewing it. And I think the tracking was just magnificent.
Yeah, I have to agree. There wasn't a single point where I looked at the tracking and thought, this doesn't really work. And I can contrast that to some work done. Do you know the the television show Heroes, when the cheerleader is sort of on the slab and her chest is opened up and all of that craziness. Where I guess they're doing a forensics on her. Maybe she's in the morgue. I'm not quite sure what's going on with the piece of wood or whatever in her head.
That is a morgue shot, yep.
Yeah, so that... There was something about the tracking in that. I can't put my finger on it, but there was something about the tracking in that because it was all this open, exposed bone and tissue and blood. Something about that just felt a little weird. And
well,
it,
in
I guess
fairness
was,
to the guys that did that, they were doing that
blurring.
On an episode. Yeah, but those guys were doing that on an episodic time frame, on an episodic budget. It was a... I just... Coming to the defense of the Heroes guys that worked on that at... I think that was at Stargate Digital. I mean, that was incredibly... That is such an impressive job for episodic television. I think it's an unfair comparison, though I'm not saying that it's not superior in the film, because it is, but it's just like if you were one of the guys that worked on that episodic show, having like 2 weeks to turn around that volume of effects. But,
right, and
yeah,
I was actually not comparing... I was not trying to make the comparison for a realism perspective. I was trying to make the comparison on a the things that you notice perspective, right, which is...
Okay.
You know, there's always some motion blur issue, or there's always something where the frame rate just doesn't seem quite right. I'm not quite exactly sure how, you know, how these things manifest themselves. But in the Dark Knight work, you know, there was none of that sort of, I guess you'd call it stuttering, you know, because when you have something that's really open and exposed and there's so much detail in it, and the detail is obviously computer generated versus the detail on the person, you get this sort of strange, almost like strobe effect. I guess.
Well, I think the other thing is it's a visual effect it's a visual effect that's causing the audience to stare at it. Like there's nowhere to hide. You know, the director wants you to look at it. You do look at it, and if it isn't
absolutely.
You get to see it. And then to be on a face makes it triply worse because we have, you know, parts of our brain specifically dedicated to processing eyes and mouths and faces, like three separate sections. So if there was ever a part of our kind of physical makeup that made visual effects hard, it's doing that kind of face stuff. And then add to that you have the perfect match to the other side of his face going on at the same time. So it's not only is it a digital face, but... And is it tracking? But is it tracking completely when you've got the realistic performance on the, in my case, camera left? I'm talking about the hospital scene now. So yeah, I don't think you can fault it technically. And I think the one that I understand from the reading on the research that our team gave us was the hardest was the car scene with the other mobster, where he does the your driver isn't so lucky shot. And apparently the tracking in that, they used two different types of tracking markers for this. They used makeup tracking markers, which might be best described as a, you know, pencil dot on the face. But they also used some low light illumination tracking markers. But it was in that shot that they probably had some of the most difficult and some of the most manual tracking to do. And again, I was looking at it. By this stage, I knew what to expect because it had been revealed in the hospital scene. So I was past my curiosity over his lack of red eyes and wonderful optometry. And so I was looking for it, and it was still a manual track that held up extremely well. And that object tracking in a low-light environment, with also the non-rigid body nature of a human face, because you're trying to track to something that isn't in of itself stable, it was just terrific.
Yeah, and I mean, to be clear, he was leaning forward and leaning left and right and leaning back. And I mean, he was the range of movement while he was in the back of the car in that scene was completely out of control. I am so impressed with the work that they did on that particular scene. I can't even, I wouldn't even know where to begin, you know.
That is actually, I mean, we often discuss what would you put on your showreel, but if I was lucky enough to be at Framestore and worked on that shot and saw that, that's going at the front of my showreel because that's that's definitely a showreel shot for me. And I think some of the finest work that Framestore did was in that car shot. That was just technically and aesthetically worked. And you know what? It was after I'd looked at it and checked it out, I then just was left with the playing out of the scene and working out, you know, what was going to happen in the scene and whether he was going to kill him and all the things that I should have been worrying about at that point. There was no sort of lingering other stuff. So let's move now to the work of Dineg, who would lead Facility. And I should say, we've been talking about digital effects here, but obviously New Deal did a great job on the miniatures that were used in the film. And I don't mean to skip over those, and there are obviously other people that contributed to areas of the film, but I just wanted to hit on those big three. And Dean Egg was lead, and they did the bat chase that led to the truck flip. Though we should point out, for those that don't know, that the truck flip was in fact done live action, and that was in of itself remarkable, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, that scene was, yeah, that scene was out of control, and that was another scene where it looks great, but in IMAX it was just spectacular. You know, the amount of information, just visual information that you had to absorb while that truck was going over.
Yeah, you know, I was sitting at a good point in the IMAX theater, like I was sitting, you know, at a nice near the back, because I knew I wanted to be higher because of the sweet spot. In a normal IMAX frame, as I know you would know, John, the sweet spot is actually about a third from the bottom of frame. So whereas a normal film, you would frame the head with, you know, less headroom, with normal amounts of headroom. In an IMAX, you actually frame with a lot more headroom because the sweet spot where the audience tends to look is lower in the frame. As a consequence, if you go into the IMAX and you have some choice, try and set up the back of the IMAX cinema because you need to be higher in the actual room to kind of adjust for that in terms of the jump to the IMAX footage. And so I was, you know, I knew all this stuff technically. I positioned myself in the right position so that I would be able to have sort of a maximum thing. And still, I found myself physically like whipping my head up to look at the top of the truck as it went over and then watching to the left as it came crashing down and then whipping around. I mean, it was just like I was standing there. It was literally felt like I was standing there watching the thing flip, which was just amazing and much better, I must say, than even when I've been to IMAX and watched things with 3D glasses on. I mean, this just really felt like I was witnessing an event, and I was looking around the event the way you would to almost, you know, it was creepy how well that was pulled off.
Yeah, I think so as well. And am I correct in saying that a lot of the buildings in that scene were not, although the truck flipping was real, that a lot of the buildings were digital?
No, pretty much the buildings were real. It was a real street. Because we spoke to Paul Franklin about this, and they really wanted to point out that was an in-camera effect done in a relatively short part of the street that was allowable because it didn't have bank vaults that were going to suddenly have all their alarms going off and stuff. The truck literally goes along, and a massive hydraulic kind of air ram telegraph pole fires in the back, and that shoots down into the asphalt or the pavement of the road surface. Now, when that happens, the truck end goes up, and because the actual front sort of part of the truck in forward of the bit that it's pulling was connected by a fixed rather than pivoting joint, it couldn't jackknife. So then the nose starts to go down, and there are claws under the front bumper to again hook into the road surface to stop it skidding. So now the road is hooked by sort of claws, the back's firing up, and you can't pivot in the middle, so it just goes all the way over in 180. And all Dean Egg did in that particular shot, other than Paul Franklin literally standing off to one side in an alleyway next to Heath Ledger in costume watching the darn thing, is that they removed the air cannon stuff and some of the stuff on the ground for lights and stuff. So they were doing effectively a road cleanup. But the thing going up, and I think also a couple of the claw things at the front bumper as it hit into the actual asphalt. But apart from that, it really was an in-camera effect, and it was just more like wire removal than it was. Not that it was wire removal, but you know, it was more like that level of paint out than it was any kind of actual digital replacement.
I see. I think I might be getting the buildings in that scene mixed up with the one of the other scenes, which is where Heath Ledger's walking down the street. I know that there were building
replacements helicopter,
in one of those two scenes.
The helicopter sequence, where the helicopter, and it's the same location, right? It's just not that actual
right,
sequence.
Exactly.
When the helicopter is brought down by the wires, there's a real helicopter going down the street. So you are correct. And then as the second that the plot dictates, the helicopter's going to go out of control and crash, the buildings that it hits and that stuff around it are digital. So, yes, they did produce a digital street for that sequence, but just the truck thing. And the only reason I kind of harp on that is I do think that the special effects guys, as opposed to the visual effects guys, pulled off just an awesome sequence. And you know, need full credit for doing it. I'd hate for anyone to think that that truck had been done digitally and take anything away from the physical guys, because I can't even imagine the conversation that would, you know. So we're going to flip this full truck in a real street with real buildings. I mean, if you hit that wrong and it smashed in one of those side buildings, the insurance claim would be through the roof.
Yeah, speaking of insurance, not to sidetrack us too much, but my understanding is that they lost an IMAX camera, one of 10 in the world.
Yes, they
during this
in that sequence, you're absolutely right. The so when they're chasing with the armored car chase, there's a lot of clever visual effects work there, and of course that then causes the Batmobile to crash, and then from the Batmobile we get the breakout kind of phoenix of the Bat Pod, or the bike, as I like to call it, and then the sequence after that leading to what we just described with the truck sequence. So in that chase sequence and with the bike, while there was an enormous amount of visual works work, and it was done digitally and with miniatures and with first unit, the first unit section had a Mercedes SUV, and it had a large crane coming out of the back of it that allowed the IMAX camera to hang a bit like a steady camera. It's not a steady cam, but like an overhead crane from the SUV. Because the actual IMAX camera, as you'd know, is enormous, horizontal load, and extremely heavy. So that gave them the flexibility to be controlling it in a fluid fashion coming out of the back of the SUV with the bike and stuff following. The trouble was that there was a whole lot of sequences where people were, you know, obviously darting between cars, and two cars came around and both connected. One went left, one went right, and literally crushed it in the middle. So it sort of did a salami kind of kroomph. I think that was that was my best effort at a sound effect, but...
Well, I thought it was excellent.
If you could have seen what my hands were doing then, you'd have been very clear as to what was going on. I always find it difficult on these podcasts to describe something, because I don't know about you, I describe anything best with a whiteboard when standing, when waving my arms around. Sitting down without the ability to do that is actually quite difficult for me. Anyway, yes, so they completely trashed an IMAX camera. And its lenses, of course. Hey, what did you think of the
chase
sequence?
And the arm
that
held it, right?
what did you think of the whole both the chase, the pre-Batmobile being trashed, the trashing the Batmobile, and the that whole action sequence?
I thought it was visually amazing. I mean, there's just very little about this film that wasn't just visually stunning. You know, that particular sequence, I had the benefit of seeing a lot of before and after, so I knew that some of the Batpod work was digital, you know, because I'd seen a lot of the renders and I'd seen a lot of sort of the early work on it. So I knew that a lot of that was digital, but I couldn't for the life of me, once the scene started moving around and the Batpod was zooming around and all that, I couldn't for the life of me tell what part of it was digital and what part of it wasn't. It just moved so quickly and it was so fluid. I thought it was great work.
Yeah, I guess you've got a strong film history appreciation. How did you actually sort of rate the chase? Because I mean, a car chase is probably the most common action film vehicle, to use a bad pun, but device that we've seen. How did you actually sort of feel about that in terms of its? Because, you know, it's been done before, a chase, obviously. This was a chase with, you know, a couple of differences. But how did you feel about it from a filmic point of view?
I thought it was the anti-car chase. I mean, there are two really great car chases in film. One of them is in a film called Bullet with Steve McQueen. And the other one is a film called Ronin. Now, you might argue that The Italian Job had a really good film chase, but a really good car chase in the film. I don't know if I agree with that. This particular car chase was not really a car chase in any traditional sense of the word, right, or the phrase. It was just this strange amalgam of all these different types of vehicles, and none of them were really stable or steady. You know, the only thing steady in the entire film as far as the vehicle was concerned was the Batmobile and the Batpod. Everything else just felt like at any second it was going to turn over on its side and just go crashing.
I guess for me, the other reference that, worked for me filmically was Mad Max 2. And in Mad Max 2, George Miller, the director, had the car chase effectively with a car on a train or a train chase. There was a set of rails and they were running in a straight line. And in that, he did a similar thing, which he set up multiple points of possible resolution. In other words, there was somebody coming at the other way. So mentally, you knew at some point they were going to crash. There was a reaching forward to get a gun cartridge, which was the last cartridge that would kill the baddie that was otherwise going to kill them. There was a guy on the car that was trying to get into the cab. There was like a series of problems that were constructed. And at any time, any one of those would cause our hero to die. And I felt that was a good kind of reference to me, because in this one, it wasn't obvious. Like in Ronan, which I think was terrific, it was the driving up the wrong way up the streets, right? Like it was a sense of crashing because you're going into oncoming traffic, and it was very well shot. I think there was also in the 60s or 70s, I'm going to say it was like a Goddard film where they were shooting the accelerator. I think I might have mentioned this once before in a podcast, where they were shooting the work on the pedals to try and get a different perspective. But in this one, I felt like it was the threat. It was, were they going to fire the, you know, bazooka that would blow up the thing? Would they just run into something? You know, there was like multiple threats. Batman was coming at one angle, the baddies were coming at another, and it wasn't, you know, either Batman chasing A chasing B. It was sort of A was being chased by B, C was coming to attack B, while B was about to wipe out both C and there was a possible D there somewhere. And it was sort of this multiple angle thing, which was reminiscent of that Mad Max 2 that I was referring to, that I think took it out of being just a straight chase. And I wondered if you... Because, I mean, again, it's the confusing nature of building that up. You know, you want to get an unusual chase, but if you go too far, the audience loses even which direction the cars are going in.
Yeah, did you feel like... So at any time in the car chase, like say I'm calling it an anti car chase, because it just didn't really feel like a traditional one. Was there no time for you where you felt like you knew how it was going to resolve, right? Because I certainly didn't. I had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah, and it was well constructed, because if Batman had been driving the vehicle that was being chased, you would have figured worst case scenario it's going to flip, and he's going to walk away. Whereas this wasn't like that. It was quite possible that. That there was going to be, you know, the van that was being chased would actually lose. It was also possible that Batman would just completely blow up the baddies. It was also possible, yeah, there was a bunch of different scenarios that were all seeming to be valid. And also, I think, while I got a hint that that I expected that, you know, our sort of, I mean, it's hard with a film where you know characters are going to survive, but Gordon, or the Gary Oldman character, I know, obviously didn't believe he was dead at that point, and so I guessed he was going to resurface. And there was that sort of one shot where there was a hooded guy in the car when one of the guys jumped in the van at the very beginning and said, set off. And because the hooded character just nodded, didn't say any lines, but obviously there was some screen time devoted to the fact that the guy that was driving was masked, I had in the back of my mind, well, that's either going to be the Joker himself, it's going to be one of the Joker's guys, or it's going to be Gary Oldman's character. But I managed to forget it within seconds because the chase was so engaging.
Right, exactly.
And it's hard, isn't it? Because you can't, as an audience, expect to not have those elements. I mean, you have to give the audience something that was where, you know, Commissioner Gordon came from. You can't have Gordon appear out of nowhere, because it's just too much of a cheat. But then if you telegraph it too much, the audience is like, well, he's obviously sitting in the front seat, you know, drama's gone. So again, difficult filmmaking to pull off successfully.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it was also one of those cases where, you know, we saw in crystal clarity, we saw that this was a film that was just not afraid to let people go, like you said early on in our discussion. You know, people were dying, and main characters in a lot of ways. And that was pretty shocking. So I don't think there was any point where I didn't at least believe that they would just kill anyone, you know. The only person you know is likely not going to die, and this is Batman, but everyone else is sort of up for grabs.
And even Batman, you know, there was, in this film, I was willing to believe that he was going to take a, fatal or near fatal blow that would, you know, because I mean, who knew whether they were going to do a kind of Batman Resurrected kind of plot line at that point, whether so yeah, I mean, you didn't expect Batman to die, but you're right, everyone else seemed to be pretty much up for grabs, and that must be pretty frightening if you're reading the script, right? Because you're like sitting there thinking, I wonder if I'm going to get into the sequel. I mean, this film has done extraordinary box office. I mean, it's literally up there now with shooting towards Titanic levels in the opening weekends and stuff. It did, you know, 160 million or something. Now, admittedly, had a bunch of previews on the Thursday night that kind of bumped it, but still, it's going to clear much more money than the first one did. And I guess that begs the question, is there any conceivable universe in which they're not going to make a Batman 3? And the obvious answer is no. I mean, there's just no way that the studio would let this franchise stop at this. But I wonder, could you speculate where you think it's going to go?
I could speculate a little bit. I mean, you know, if you're familiar with the comic book history, there are a lot of times in the comic book where Bruce Wayne really starts to question himself as Batman and whether he's doing the right thing. And this film, I think, set that up a lot. And it set up the idea that, you know, there could be, I mean, with the Joker as a great example, you know, there could be just completely devious villains who come out of nowhere. And I think that what the filmmaker really, I think what Batman really needs is they need to take the villain up just a little bit. I'm not talking about in the Mr. Freeze category of insanity, like in the previous ones, but I think the villain needs to be just a little bit, you know, harder to kill, a little bit more resilient. You know, it needs to be something that really tests the Batman character in a stronger way, you know, both psychologically and physically and all of these different things. And I think we got a little bit of a foreshadowing of that when, you know, Bruce Wayne asks for a bat suit that was more flexible. You know, he's no longer just this menacing, ominous character. You know, he needs something more flexible, something where he can really get around in a much better way. You know, so there's a lot of opportunities there to strengthen him as a character and to strengthen the suit.
I guess one of the, you've touched on a really interesting plot point as well from this film, which is that I loved the fact that Heath Ledger's character, the Joker, points out what he managed to pull off with just some bullets and explosives. In other words, if Batman is meant to be just a guy with some good gadgets, the Joker is just... now, obviously, he had quite a lot of gadgets. I mean, he couldn't rig up multiple ferries with timers and stuff. But still, the Joker, you know, even to the when he's blowing up the hospital and the button doesn't quite work, like, he's just not... It's not got the sense that he's got an enormous organization behind him. He has no superhero powers. He has no intellect beyond the belief of man that he's able to solve problems in a, you know, that no one else can even think of. He's just a psycho that's just beyond, you know, but he's not in the sense anyway a supervillain. If that makes sense, like, he's not the, he doesn't have any special powers, doesn't have any special whatever. And yet look at the trouble that he wreaks. And so I guess I loved that about this film. So you're thinking that to go to play counterpoint to that, to actually have the next villain have some real edge over the environment?
I think that would be the direction that I would certainly take it in, is to just take it up a little bit. I mean, we've seen, you know, what can happen in the sort of, you know, normal person side of it. I mean, the thing that made the Joker impossible to figure out or to stop or any of that was just he was so unpredictable. I mean, I don't think he even himself in a lot of ways knew what he was going to do next until he did it, right? I mean, he certainly planned things out with some measure, but he was so completely psychotic in so many different ways, you just had no idea what he was going to do next. You know, in the first Batman Begins, you know, we had the opportunity for something to be dropped into the water supply, right? Something that would just cause people to become insane. Which is interesting because then the sequel is literally, an arch enemy or a villain who is the ultimate version of what insanity looks like, but still somehow functional. You know, with this single-minded purpose of, you know, I have to kill the Batman. You know, I'll burn money, I'll do whatever, but I have to kill the Batman. That's his whole, you know, that's what he believed would turn society around.
And yet, even there, they don't stop at that, do they? Because then there's that marvelous thing about, I think we're going to keep doing this forever because you won't kill me and you're too much fun to have around. I mean, how complex is that? That even the main character who seemed to has one purpose, just to kill Batman, isn't at the end saying, you know, I'll get you. Don't worry, I'll get you. You know, he's saying, well, I think we'll just keep playing this dance forever. I mean, that was just, again, plays into my theory about it being such a great film and being so operatic, but that was a nice touch, don't you think? And I think surely, yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It just reminded me when we were talking about, you know, there was a lot of talking in this film. I don't know if you noticed that. I mean, it went by really fast and the dialogue was mostly just phenomenally good. But the one part of the film, I was thinking about what took me out of the film. I really remember in Batman Begins, Batman didn't speak very much, and I sort of mentioned that earlier. The one thing in this version, The Dark Knight, that took me out a little bit was when Batman started talking. I thought he spoke just a little too much. There was something about that voice, that sort of artificially deep and frightening voice, that I really had to reel in from. And so there were a lot of scenes that I was happy about because the Joker character would sort of comment to him about how scary he was or that sort of thing. So it kind of almost deflated Batman in a way. I mean, I don't know why they didn't just call this film The Joker, frankly.
You know what was interesting also, and I think if I was to pick a way that I would go with the next one, I would, again, avoiding the Mr. Freeze thing, I would have slightly more sense of humor. Because when they had that bit at the beginning with the Batman wannabes and the whole, you know, what's the difference between you and I? Well, I'm not wearing a hockey vest. I mean, that was pretty bloody funny. That was that you would have all these vigilantes that would be wanting to imitate him and him having to put up with these lunatics just kind of getting in the way. I mean, it was funny without being silly funny. You know, it wasn't like Mr. Freeze funny. And I guess I could have, you know, if you're doing a different film, I don't want to change this one at all, but if I was doing a different film, I'd add a bit more of that in. I'd add a bit more of like him having to deal with the issue of being so well known and, you know, like, I don't know what it would be, you know, the idea that the police department wouldn't try very hard because they just expected him to turn up and solve it for them kind of level stuff would be nice to pepper into a third film, I guess. But, you know, I don't know where you'd go on a third film. I don't think I want to be the actor that's trying to play the third film's villain because the comparisons to Heath Ledger will be just, as you say, impossible to overcome.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting that this film is called The Dark Knight and it has that set of scenes in the beginning with the people trying to mimic Batman. There's a Frank Miller, very well-known Frank Miller graphic novel called The Dark Knight where it's an older Batman, where he sort of comes out of retirement in the graphic novel. And there's a lot of that going on, a lot of sort of people trying to pretend to be him, if memory serves. I haven't read it in a while. But I wonder if that was a nod to the Frank Miller version of The Dark Knight. Kind of an interesting approach, I think.
It is really hard to imagine that we're applauding this film so much, given how badly it had been taken so relatively recently with the... I think it was, who was the director of the Dr. Freeze, Poison Ivy, Batman and Robin one? It was Joe Schumacher, wasn't it?
I think it was
Joe Schumacher. And I think I remember at the time, I hated that film, and I think I remember at the time deciding I was never going to see any film that he ever directed again. But I think one of the things that I hated was a comment he made, and I think like Cinefix or whatever, which was, it's a comic book, we can do anything. And I just remember thinking at the time, because they were talking about the fact that they hold onto the side of a rocket as it's flying up, right? And it's like, well, we figured, you know, it's a comic book, we can do anything. And I thought that showed such a lack of respect, both for the material, but also for the audience, right? That, hey, you know, it's like what it is, and the audience is just, you know, won't care, and it's just all funny, and it's just... And I was like, well, you know, you just don't care about this material. This is not... You just shouldn't be directing this. And I'm sorry for Joel if he's listening, I decided I didn't have to watch any more of his films again, but it was, you know, it was, I think there's something to be said, and I think I've said this before, I'm not a big, you know, graphic novel guy, I don't buy those things, I don't have any problem with people that do, and I have enormous respect for the artistry that goes into drawing them, but I just personally don't read that, and so I'm not familiar with, you know, a lot of the things that you've been citing, like particular references to stuff, so maybe that is a layer there that I'm completely missing. But I do, as somebody that isn't into that, respect the fact that they seem to respect us as an audience. They're not just feeding us anything is possible. And here's an impossible situation, so he's going to press a button to get out of it. And I think that can be pretty much applied to across the board. Any film, you can pick any genre you like. I think the more you respect the audience, just full stop, the better off you are. In fact, I go even further than that and say, right down to podcasts, right? Any kind of entertainment and stuff that you do. When people's primary focus is sort of self-serving and not that of the audience, then it fails. You know, when it's self-indulgent, it fails. When it's, we're not going to care that you want to have this solved in a clever fashion, it fails. When the plot is written in such a fashion that they just couldn't be bothered to come up with a clever way, then you're just disrespecting the audience. And so maybe it's ironic that I'm such an advocate of this film, given I'm not, you know, into the material, but wouldn't you agree, like, at some point you just get that they respect the audience and they're not saying, we're just here to take your money?
Well, and we have a director in Christopher Nolan who, frankly, respected his audience from his first film that I saw, which was The Following, and then the follow-up to The Following, which was Memento. Memento is a film that respects its audience so deeply that it assumes that as an audience, you're thoughtful and intelligent and considerate enough to understand, you know, the odd temporal shifts that he's making in that film. I think The Prestige is another great example of that. I'm sort of blown away. I was thinking about Nolan the other day, and I was thinking, here's a guy whose first film that anyone has really even heard of was released in 2000, and here we are 8 years later, and he has directed what I think is inarguably the best film this year. I mean, maybe the best film in a long time.
Well, yeah.
You know, whether you like Batman or The Joker, it doesn't matter, any of those things. I think it's an inarguable or an immutable, as I like to say, fact that The Dark Knight is, from the cinematography perspective and the special effects perspective, it's the best film I've seen in a long, long time.
I think I'd say that it's the best film we've seen in a long, long time in its zone. And the only reason I say that is that I do think that, you know, it's a film with a tremendous amount of material to have to work with going in, a huge budget and A-list everybody, right? And I think that there probably are films out there that have done a magnificent job that are completely different types of film than just... I'll give you an example. I personally love Stranger Than Fiction. I think it's a beautifully crafted story, incredibly well acted. The actors are playing against their normal comic kind of beats, and I can't compare that film to this. It's just not a fair comparison. Not that one is better than the other, it's just that they're such oddly different films that I don't want to compare them. But if we just say for a second, in terms of a mainstream film, it's without a doubt, I think, the best film we've seen in like, you know, maybe 5 years. But
right. Well, I tend to compare almost everything to a film called My Blueberry Nights. You've probably heard me talk about it on and on and on. It just had a tiny, tiny little budget, but it was shot so well. And then another film that I like to mention quite frequently is a film called Brick. You know, Brick is a film that just had a very small budget, but it was just pitch perfect as a film. Now, I wouldn't compare it to Batman Begins or to, you know, The Dark Knight in any way, right? Other than they're both in the category of film. So I hear exactly what you're saying. But I mean
let's take Memento, right?
Spider-Man
you mentioned Memento.
3.
Memento is a masterpiece of editing and structure. I mean, I just think it's stunning how good that film is. I don't necessarily say it's better than this film because to a certain extent it's device driven, but it was a stunning film. Interestingly, it had another Australian in the lead role, which, you know, Guy Pearce. Because obviously we're quite, you know, proud of our actors. It's only our cinematographers, but still, that is another. I mean, that is a magnificent film. Anyone hasn't seen Memento, go get it. And anyone that's seen that thinks they've sort of maybe looked at Memento and I don't know, no, go and see it, and make sure you are uninterrupted in watching it. If you're like eating dinner or doing anything else while watching Memento, stop. It's a film that just sit down, turn the lights down, and pretend you're at the cinema and watch it because it. I mean, it's. Is there a better... I can't even think of a better film in terms of structure. And can you?
Not off the top of my head. That certainly was a breakaway film. To watch it is like settling in for an experience that you've never had before if you haven't seen it.
So you're right. Thinking, sorry, go on.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say you're right. I hadn't thought of, you know, in all this stuff that we've been discussing, I haven't really thought about Chris Nolan's career. And you're right, in a relatively short amount of time, he's come up with not just a couple of good films, but some really amazing films, and not all in the same... Because, I mean, I loved The Prestige. I thought that was a really good film as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if we're comparing films, just for a moment, I don't want to get too far into this rat hole, as they say. This is a Spider-Man 3 film. I mean, if you want to compare head-to-head, it's a sequel. It's a comic book fantasy. It's, you know, a huge budget. Now, Spider-Man 3, the production budget of that film was $260 million. So I would definitely say you could compare Spider-Man 3 to Batman The Dark Knight. You know, if you were just comparing production budgets. And I would also say that if you were to compare them, The Dark Knight looks like, relative to Spider-Man 3, looks like it had a production budget of about $1 billion. I mean, it literally looks like five times the production budget of Spider-Man 3.
Well, not only that, but, I mean, Spider-Man 3, while having a couple of good things, like, you know, I think the sand guy at the beginning forming and collapsing in that pit was really beautiful work and fabulous CG. The problem we discussed with losing the audience, I mean, God, you couldn't have picked a better example for a film that I hated for its inability to respect the audience in terms of editing, when there are sequences in that where I'm just sitting there going, okay, you're flying down, he's flying after you, you know, whatever, can we just get over this incredibly fast-cutting montage? Because I don't know who is doing what to... I mean, I can read visually very quickly. You can play me stuff at 25 frames a second or 24, and I can spot dirt, and I can, you know, get a single frame that has a slight glint. I mean, my eyes are really highly trained to that. And yet I sit there going, you know what? You're just ridiculously confusing things down these CG streets and impossible camera angles, and things are flying at me, and I'm just bored now. Like, it's like I'm switching off. Wait till we get out of this sequence and I'll, like, pay attention again, kind of thing. And that's horrendous, that a film that should be that good, you can just disengage because it's just become almost visual noise for the fight sequences. And again, all those plot devices we described, the incredibly big, threatening, evil version of Spidey, who has ridiculously malformed teeth that make you... I know it's from the comic book, but I don't buy it. It just doesn't feel real. There's some CG stuff. It's, you know, Spidey's going to get killed, and oh, at the last second he comes through, and there you go. And... Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about Venom in that case. Yeah. That was a little weak.
It was, wow. Well, the whole ending was weak. I mean, I think you're right. You can compare it to Dark Knight, except for you can't. You can
right.
do it on
well,
paper.
It's a comic book and a sequel, right? You know.
No. I mean,
it's in the
can,
same category.
Can, no, you're absolutely right. I'm not arguing with your premise. I just am reinforcing it by agreeing how one fades in comparison to the other. You know. Let's compare the Rolling Stones to some British boy band by, you know, way of comparison. It's just, you know, this just, I don't know. I mean, it's so true you can compare them that I wouldn't even think of comparing them, because I think this film is so much better. Hey, it's been great talking to you. We probably need to wind up.
Absolutely.
I don't think we should even bother with our normal discussion of any shots that you thought were really bad or took you out of it. I do normally rate films based on what the shots through the car driving shots look like. If the composite looks like it really was driving and outside the window looked real, and they've so ticked that box, that I'm not even gonna shame it by discussing it. This film is completely nailed its visual effects. All the houses deserve, I think, enormous props. And I wonder, in just finishing though, if I could, and I don't think it's the ultimate arbiter of taste, but what do you think the Academy's approach is going to be to this film come Oscar time? Do you think that it's going to actually cross out of genre and start being taken seriously for Oscar type consideration, or is it still going to be seen as a, you know, genre comic book thing that doesn't deserve serious Academy attention?
Well, there's been some discussion that Heath Ledger is actually you know, going to be nominated for an Oscar for his performance. And, you know, my perspective on that is, I mean, it's a little bit morbid, and it's, I think it's a little bit, it's disappointing to me that his death is the thing that I think is going to cause the Oscar committee to take him seriously in this performance.
I'm going to call you on that one. I think that had he not had Brokeback Mountain, that might be true. But the Academy...
I see what you're saying. Brokeback Mountain was the catalyst for this, not his demise. And
well, because they're going to say, this guy can act, he's a serious actor, and he's giving an acting performance. They're not going to see him as... Because I think, you know, when you've had a performance that's got so much... Because he was nominated for that, and that really got him heavily on their radar, that I'm willing to buy that before the film came out, there was a morbid curiosity to see it, but I don't think that the discussion since has been predicated on a morbid thing about him now being dead so much as it just people honestly saying, as you did, this film should be called The Joker.
Yeah, and it might just be me as an American being, I believe the phrase is an armchair quarterback, now that I think about it.
There you go, that was what I was trying to get.
You know, just sort of thinking about, you know, as an American, I have a very strange, you know, we tend to like to watch Jerry Springer in car crashes. And so I have this skewed perspective on what causes people to rise to action. And so I really appreciate you putting some international perspective on that, because you're right. His performance was just good, and full stop. Right. I mean, it was just a great performance, regardless of anything else.
I think also
and Oscar worthy.
Yeah, I think also if we could move past his performance, which I don't want to take anything away from it, I've got an impression that, and I could be wrong, I haven't looked at this mathematically, but it seems like any film that gets rewarded tremendously at the box office, the Academy's kind of, well, you already got your props, so I don't need to give you an Oscar kind of thing. And it's not the case normally, though I guess Lord of the Rings may run in counter this point, that a film that's massively successful at the box office tends to sweep up at the Oscars. It seems in the last few years that most of the films have been, you know, smaller, more serious films than blockbuster, tentpole, summer release types. You know, it's almost like the big blockbuster summer releases never get considered for Oscars, and it's always the independent, smaller films that are seen to need the attention and tend to get rewarded. So, as I say, probably Lord of the Rings is counter to that. But I'm wondering whether, for example, it's inconceivable that this film would be nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think we both agree that it should be. I mean, it may not win, but it should be nominated. And I certainly know that if I were putting together Best Picture, I mean, this hands down, far and away, this is the Best Picture I've seen in any category this year.
And in terms of visual effects, I wonder again if it's going to get recognition, because at some level, I don't know, I'm just like, is the visual effects category now the biggest or the most serving of the plot? And I think it's the biggest. And so I'm kind of worried that it may not get Oscar recognition in visual effects, because they'll go, well, a lot of it was in camera, which, you know, shouldn't take anything away because the special effects guy should be nominated. And also they'll be like, well, it wasn't, you know, a new set of technologies. It was just doing it at, say, IMAX res. Because, you know, what seems to be the case in the Oscar category for visual effects is they're looking for something that hasn't been done before that's big and huge and huge shot count. Have you been to the Bake Off in LA for the Oscars?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so you know what it's like. It's this sort of presentation of stuff. And I got a real feeling from the Bake Off that people are after new and hasn't been done before. And I don't know that that's what we should be rewarding. I think what we should be rewarding in visual effects is very well done, serves the plot, and is really what was appropriate. Like in costume design, you don't just look for what's new. You look for what serves the plot and was done really well. And in music, it's not like, well, this is avant-garde music that's never been used before. It's just like, this is appropriate music for the scoring of this film. So, again, For all we're raving about it, if it doesn't go well outside Heath Ledger's category, outside the acting category, if it doesn't go well at the Oscars, I don't think that would prove anything. I think it could be But let's wait and see. I guess that's not for a while yet. That'll be like, what, 6 months from now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, John, tell me, you've just launched a couple of new podcasts in finishing up. Do you want to tell us what you've been up to? And we heard last week, you know, some of your background in terms of filmmaking, but I don't think we actually heard what you're doing and what some of these side projects are at the moment.
Yeah, as everyone probably knows, I'm a pretty frequent co-host on This Week in Media, which I think I mentioned. But I am in the process of launching a couple of things. One is I'm launching a micro studio called Unscale, which is kind of a beginning to end. You know, we start at shooting and end at delivering. I guess motion theory is another micro studio in that sense. But I'm launching a micro studio called Unscale. And part of what I'm doing as that particular micro studio is I'm launching 5 podcasts. One a month, and they're video podcasts over the next coming months. One of them is That Media Show, which I think you alluded to earlier, and it's just an insider's look at Hollywood and special effects and that sort of thing. I don't know, how would you describe That Media Show, having seen it?
It's interesting, actually. We at FX Guide were toying with a format like that with our FX Guide TV show. We decided to move away from what I think That Media Show is, which is covers more sort of news and the zeitgeist of what's happening, and focus more on sort of feature interviews. So I'm glad that you're picking up the other side of that and doing the shorter, newsier pieces, because the shows aren't that long, are they? They're kind of quite rich and dense in material.
Yeah, it's typically 5 to 7 minutes per show, and the idea is, yeah, to just talk about, it's basically my way of revolting or rebelling against the kind of Entertainment Weeklies of the world. I think that there should be a show that is much more focused on the people behind the scenes or behind the camera, the kind of insider look at what's going on. So we do talk about things like Framestore or Double Negative's work on the show. And I think that's really interesting. And the next show that comes out next week, and it's a lot more detailed from that perspective. You know, we're still finding our sea legs. I mean, we did a pilot and then one episode, so episode 2 comes out next week.
Yeah, I guess from my point of view, we've decided at FX Guide that what we're going to, I wouldn't say retreat into, but what we like is longer, more in-depth stuff. And we're kind of moving less and less from the, because I think that your show's great, but it's you're covering a wide range of material in a single episode, which is terrific, and it's a good, you know, weekly kind of... Is it weekly? Weekly catch-up?
It is weekly, yep.
Yeah, whereas what we're trying to do is more like in-depth looks at things where it's just one topic per show, and I think there's room for lots of things on the internet. It's a big internet. I've never felt differently than that. So I think it's good, and I think it's a good addition. And of course, as everyone knows from any of the stuff that I'm involved in, I can't do anything that lasts only 5 minutes. It's impossible to keep me to 5 minutes on anything. I can't even get out of bed for 5 minutes. So, but that's
nice.
The other show that you're doing, which I find both amusing and interesting to listen to, is Life Zero.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, that's my personal sort of passion show, right? That's the show that I do. In a lot of ways, I don't know if it will ever make any money or if anyone will ever sponsor it, really, or any of that kind of thing. But I just do it because I really care about the topic, and I think it's worth discussing. I like to call it Charlie Rose for lifestyle design.
Yeah, and I heard you call it that last week, actually. And I have a significantly different point of view, though... Ironically, I applaud many of the aspects of the Life Zero rules, but having 2 children, the concept of getting my life down to only owning 100 things, I don't think even my medicine cabinet has more than 100 things in it, yet alone the rest of my life. So, but yes, it's fun. And also, there are some other good people on that show with you.
Yeah, Ben Durbin is on that show, as is Laura Lee, who I think that's the only show she's on, so... Although we are launching another show in the spirit of That Media Show, which I think she's going to be hosting.
Oh, good. Well, she's the voice of that's closer to my point of view, because I've certainly been bored in doctor's surgeries. So there you go. so we're going to We have a bunch of good films coming out to talk about with the VFX show. I just wanted to thank our Pixel Corp for making this show possible, and also our producers in particular, Christian Martin, Kevin Hansen, and Laurie. Now, I'm going to get this right. I swear to God I am. Laurie's surname is Apthorpe. I think that's right. I've been practicing that. I'm sorry, Laurie, if it isn't right. But they, Christian, Kevin, and Laurie do an enormously great job in preparing and producing our shows each week. We want to thank them. We also want to make sure that you guys visit pixelcore.tv for the show notes, and the guys go to trouble to put all the links. So we mentioned obscure, you know, 60s films here, and then these poor guys have to go and hunt through, try and work out what film it was that that we were referring to, so they can put a show note there. But just to save you having to write down while we're talking, if you're interested to follow up any of those things, they're there, as of course are all the previous episodes. And I think we're up to like coming up to 50 in a few weeks' time. So there we go. Thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll get you back again. And David was going to join us this week, but they were digging up his house, and so his internet line was gone. And I know Mark is also keen. And we're going to be doing a special from SIDGRAPH in a couple of weeks' time. So will you be at SIDGRAPH?
I am still trying to figure that one out. I also have a child who's 5, and I share custody. And so that may be the week that I spend with him here in San Francisco. We'll see.
Yeah, well, obviously, if it is, that's much more important. But if you are free, we'd love to... No, I'm serious. I mean, family's much more important. There's no question about it.
I was laughing in agreement. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
SIGGRAPH totally. Or my kid? SIGGRAPH loses.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But if you are free, we'll be in SIGGRAPH. We're going to be broadcasting at FX Guide and FX Guide TV from SIGGRAPH. But until then, thank you so much for joining us, John. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Love being on the show. Love listening to it.
And thank you guys for listening. We really do, you know, this is only made possible because you guys listen. So if you want to send us feedback or post notes in the forum at pixelcore.tv, please go right ahead. We visit it quite regularly and answer it. Until next time, thanks so much. See you.